From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
With the very sad passing of Pope John Paul II, the Church is today at a critical crossroads. While he has moved the Church forward in many ways, he has also been extremely conservative.
Pope John Paul II has died. We'll look at his 26-year leadership of the Catholic Church. And today is the anniversary of the death of another world figure, Dr. Martin Luther King. We'll hear an excerpt of his Beyond Vietnam speech, which he gave on April 4th, 1967, a year to the day before his assassination.
The image of America will never again be the image of revolution, freedom, and democracy. But the image of violence and militarism.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Up to 2 million pilgrims are expected to travel to Rome this week to mark the passing of Pope John Paul II. The Pope died Saturday night at the age of 84. The Church's cardinals decided today the funeral of the Pope will be held at the Vatican on Friday. He will then be buried in the crypt between St. Peter's Basilica. The Pope is now lying in state in the Basilica. The Polish-born Pope leaves behind a legacy that defies easy description. On social issues, he was a fierce conservative, opposed abortion, birth control, same-sex marriage, and women in the priesthood. At the same time, the Pope's views on other issues often clashed with conservative forces in this country. Prior to the invasion of Iraq, the Pope forcibly called for peace and criticized the U.S. war plans. He said, quote, "War is not always inevitable. It is always a defeat for humanity." He opposed the death penalty and was a longtime supporter of a Palestinian state. Despite protests from Israel, he personally met with the late Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat a number of times. Economically, the Pope warned about the effects of what he once described as, quote, unbridled, savage capitalism. Politically, Pope John Paul II has been widely credited for helping to bring about the fall of communism by inspiring workers in his native Poland to rise up against the Soviet-controlled regime. His message to the Polish people was simple: be not afraid. At the same time, he was seen as a friend of Cuba. On Saturday, Fidel Castro sent his condolences to the Vatican and favorably recalled the Pope's 1998 visit, during which the Pope condemned the U.S. blockade of the island. The Cuban government described the Pope as, quote, someone who cared for the poor, someone who fought neoliberalism and struggled for peace. However, the Pope was also widely criticized in Latin America for rejecting priests who advocated liberation theology as a means to uplift the poor. By using modern technology, the Pope reached out to the world in a manner never before seen for a leader of the Catholic Church. He visited a record 120 nations and was seen in person by millions. By church standards, his term was extraordinary. He was the first non-Italian pope in over 400 years. He served the third longest term in papal history. He also reached out to the Jewish and Muslim faiths like no other pope. He apologized for the church's anti-Semitic past and became the first pope to enter a mosque. And his views will be long felt inside the church. He's appointed all but three of the cardinals who will soon be meeting in private to pick his successor. We'll look more at the legacy of Pope John Paul II in a few minutes. In other news, the Iraqi parliament has taken the first step to forming a new government. After 2 months of delays, lawmakers approved the Sunni leader Hajim al-Hassani as Speaker of the Parliament. Next, the lawmakers will pick a prime minister and president. Prior to the meeting of parliament, Baghdad was put in a state of near lockdown in order to prevent attacks. Major bridges in and out of Baghdad were closed, and restrictions were placed on driving inside the city. Meanwhile, 44 U.S. soldiers were injured after Iraqi militants staged a surprise attack on the U.S.-run Abu Ghraib prison. First, a car bomb exploded outside the jail. That was followed by another bomb, then gunfire, then a grenade attack. Over three dozen Iraqi militants were involved in the attack. The head of Blackwater Security is coming under criticism after it was revealed he openly admitted it's, quote, fun to shoot some people. Blackwater is one of the largest private security firms in Iraq. The Observer newspaper of London obtained a company newsletter that quotes Blackwater President Gary Jackson as also saying terrorists, quote, need to get creamed and it's fun, meaning satisfying, to do the shooting of such folk, he said. In Zimbabwe, President Robert Mugabe's ruling party has claimed victory in last week's election. According to results released by the Zimbabwe Election Commission, Mugabe's party secured enough seats to gain a two-thirds majority in the nation's parliament. The opposition, as well as the U.S. and British governments, have refused to recognize the outcome, claiming the vote is rigged. However, neighboring South Africa said the outcome reflects, quote, the free will of the people. In Arizona, a group calling itself the Minuteman Project has begun stationing volunteers along the Mexican border to track down immigrants. The Mexican government has described the volunteers as vigilantes. The group claims to have recruited about 1,000 people, including 30 pilots with aircraft. The project has been met by protests. Mexico's National Human Rights Commission recently cited the Minuteman Project as a sign that anti-immigrant extremism is rising in the United States. Meanwhile, the American Civil Liberties Union has sent observers to keep tabs on the Minuteman volunteers to ensure they don't take the law into their own hands. On Sunday, the Minuteman Project claimed to have helped the official Border Patrol arrest 18 immigrants. Meanwhile, in New Mexico, a 32-year-old man remains hospitalized in critical condition after being dragged from a truck on Easter Sunday. The Mexican-born man, Fausto Arellano, suffered burn-like abrasions over half his body after he was bound by the ankles and dragged from a truck 4,000 feet through the streets of Gallup, New Mexico. Police arrested one suspect Friday and charged him with kidnapping, aggravated battery, and assault with intent to commit a violent felony. Police have not yet described the incident as a hate crime. In business news, the stock value of stun gun manufacturer Taser has dropped to its lowest value in a year. On Friday, the company's stock plummeted 13% as Amnesty International announced in a new report that the so-called non-lethal weapon resulted in 103 deaths in the U.S. and Canada over the past 5 years. Meanwhile, on Sunday, the nation's largest organization of police chiefs recommended police agencies begin closely monitoring their use of taser guns because of safety concerns. After 6 years on the run, wanted animal rights activist Peter Young has been arrested. Federal officials have accused the 27-year-old of freeing some 8,000 mink from fur farms in Wisconsin, South Dakota, and Iowa. He's been charged with engaging in animal enterprise terrorism and unlawfully interfering with interstate commerce. Young has been a federal fugitive for 6 years. He faces up to 82 years in prison. In Montana, state lawmakers have overwhelmingly passed a resolution criticizing the Patriot Act. The sponsor of the bill described the resolution as the nation's most strongly worded criticism of the law to date. The resolution encourages law enforcement agencies in Montana not to participate in investigations authorized under the Patriot Act that violate the constitutional rights of state residents. Meanwhile, the Bush administration revealed on Friday it requested and won approval to carry out a record number of special warrants last year for secret wiretaps and searches inside the country. The number of secret search requests have increased by 75% since President Bush took office. The warrants have allowed the FBI to break into homes, offices, hotel rooms, automobiles, and to eavesdrop on telephone conversations. Agents also have pried into safe deposit boxes, watched from afar with video cameras and binoculars, and intercepted emails. Japanese-American civil rights pioneer Fred Korematsu has died at the age of 86. During World War II, Korematsu was jailed after he refused orders to be sent to an internment camp set up for U.S. residents of Japanese ancestry. After the attack at Pearl Harbor, the U.S. government ordered 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry to leave their homes and be placed in the camps. Korematsu's attorney compared him to Rosa Parks. Korematsu challenged his arrest, and the case eventually went to the Supreme Court. The court upheld the establishment of the internment camps. Decades later, a federal court decided to vacate Korematsu's conviction after it was uncovered that the federal government had lied to the high court about the threat posed by Japanese Americans. In 1998, President Clinton awarded Korematsu a Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor. Clinton said, quote, "In the long history of our country's constant search for justice, some names of ordinary citizens stand for millions of souls. Plessy, Brown, Parks. To that distinguished list today, we add the name of Fred Korematsu." And 37 years ago today, April 4th, 1968, Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. He was 39 years old. He was in Memphis to organize a march of sanitation workers protesting against low wages and poor working conditions. We'll hear an excerpt of Dr. King later in the program.
You've seen the mountaintop. And he knew he could not stop. Always living with the threat of death ahead. Folks, you'd better stop and think. Everybody knows we're on the brink. What will happen now that the king?
Nina Simone, the king of love, is dead. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Up to 200,000 mourners filled St. Peter's Square Sunday at the Vatican to mark the passing of Pope John Paul II. The Pope died on Saturday night at the age of 84. Officials announced the cause of death as septic shock, an infection causing organ failure and cardiovascular system collapse. A massive funeral is scheduled to take place on Friday. Rome authorities are bracing for as many as 2 million mourners, including more than 100 heads of state, in the largest such event the city has ever seen. John Paul's 26-year leadership of the Roman Catholic Church was the third longest in history. He was the first non-Italian pope in over 400 years. During his papacy, he visited a record 120 nations and was seen in person by millions. On Sunday, mourners filed past the pope as his body lay in state at the Vatican's palace's Clementine Hall. He was dressed in crimson vestments and a white bishop's mitre, his head resting on a stack of gold pillows. A rosary was wound around his hands and a staff tucked under his left forearm. The ceremony was put on view for the world for the first time in history by Vatican TV. The Pope's body will be transferred to St. Peter's Basilica Monday afternoon for public viewing. Meanwhile, the College of Cardinals convened today in the Vatican's Apostolic Palace in the first of the series of daily sessions, which will deal with the day-to-day running of the Church and prepare for elections for a new pope to be held between 15 and 20 days after his death. Steps toward new leadership have already begun, with many of the top Vatican officials stepping down. The new pope will choose cardinals to lead his administration. Today, we'll spend much of the hour discussing the life of Pope John Paul II. We're joined in our studio by Angela Bonavaglia, an award-winning journalist author who covers social, health, and religious and women's issues. Her latest book is Good Catholic Girls, How Women Are Leading the Fight to Change the Church. It was released last month. We're joined on the telephone from New Jersey by Mary Seegers, a professor of political science at Rutgers University and expert on American Catholicism, the Roman Catholic Church, and the relationship between religion and politics in the United States. Her books include Church Polity and American Politics, Issues in Contemporary American Catholicism, and The Catholic Church and Abortion Politics, A View from the States. We're also joined on the line by Blaise Bompain, the director of the Office of the Americas. He was a Catholic priest in Guatemala during the 1960s, where he was expelled for his efforts on behalf of the poor and disenfranchised. His most recent book is called Common Sense for the 21st Century. He's also a commentator on Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. We're going to begin with our guest on the telephone from New Jersey. We're joined by Mary Seegers from Rutgers. Can you talk about the significance of Pope John Paul II, Professor Seegers?
Yes, I'd be glad to. Good morning, Amy, and all the listeners. The Pope, I think, this is an extraordinary papacy that we have witnessed, all 26 years of it. And I think he's remarkable for having restored or renewed or even inaugurated an appreciation of Catholicism worldwide, which is quite extraordinary. The Church may have been in disarray when he became Pope, and through force of his personality and travels, he's made many people who are not Catholic aware of his view of the message of Jesus Christ. So what I sensed yesterday in all of the churches were full here in the United States, and what I sensed was Catholics themselves finally sort of got a kind of renewed sense of the appreciation of this religious tradition. too many times in the past, the Catholic Church has been kind of dismissed or trivialized, at least in popular culture, as a church that has sort of warped views on sexuality. Well, you know, there's a lot more, obviously, and I think John Paul II kind of illustrated that.
Can you talk about the significance of where he came from Poland?
Yes, he is referred to as a Polish pope, and I think that is very significant. I was a Fulbright lecturer at the University of Warsaw in 1999, and so I got a chance to see a little bit of that firsthand, including I was there when the Pope came to visit in the year 1999. And so you get a sense of what he meant to the Poles. Clearly, this was a Pope who was influenced by the Nazi occupation of Poland through which he lived, and then by the subsequent 43 years of communist rule of Poland through which he also lived. I think that left him with a sense of the importance of individual dignity, the battle that all of the Polish church authorities and leaders fought with the communist government was real. Some of their churches were destroyed. The communist authorities made it very difficult to build new churches. So that when John Paul was the Archbishop of Krakow trying to build new churches, he was constantly running into that sort of thing. The church in Poland at that time was about the only place, for example, that you could go to the movies. It was the only place that you could assemble, talk about peaceful assembly, to discuss issues of the day. in talking to young students at the University of Warsaw 5 years ago who had lived through this, they described communism in Poland as immoral, as a system of complete cronyism, everything depended upon who you knew, a system of lies and deceit, and they spoke about it in the harshest terms as absolutely immoral. Now, that obviously influenced the Pope, and so his sense of human dignity came from that distinctive experience of having Jewish friends who were carted off to the concentration camps during the Nazi period, and then this sense of being in a beleaguered church fighting for survival under the Polish communist regime.
Can you talk about how this non-Italian pope became pope, how unusual it was?
Oh, it clearly was very unusual at that time. As you said in your introduction, it was 400 years of Italian popes consecutively, and that was finally broken in 1978. There were, at the time of that conclave, that papal election, there were one quarter of the College of Cardinals were Italian, and they apparently split between two of their own candidates. And so Karol Wojtyła, this cardinal from Krakow in Poland, emerged as a kind of middle compromise candidate. And I think after 8 days of a conclave, he was named the Pope. We generally know very little about these papal conclaves because the cardinals are sworn to rigorous secrecy once they enter into the conclave and are literally locked up there. And it's only in years later that we begin to get a few examples of or narratives about what actually went on.
Can you talk, Professor Seegers, about what we expect in the future? Who are the people who could succeed this pope?
Well, the College of Cardinals today is very different from what it was in 1978 when John Paul II was elected. There are many more bishops now from Latin America and Africa and Asia. There are even fewer Italian cardinals proportionally. The cardinals, for example, from Brazil outnumber the Italian cardinals. And so it's quite possible that we could have another non-Italian cardinal, although there are sort of rumors from Rome that, after all, the Italians do regard this as something of a position that perhaps an Italian should fill, because after all, the Pope is the Pope of the whole world, but he's also the Bishop of Rome. And so there's some speculation that maybe the Italians would dearly love to elect one of their own again. But I think that you could also see a possible candidate emerging from the Brazilian bishops or some of the other Latin American prelates. There's a whole series of names put forward, of course, and there are Europeans, the Archbishop of Vienna, Christoph Schönbrunn, Gottfried Daniels, who's the Archbishop of Brussels, and Walter Kasper, who is a German cardinal. It's possible that some of those others could be named as well, but it does seem to be doubtful that any American cardinal would be named at the moment.
Why?
I think because America is the superpower that it is, and it probably would be looked at as in a global sense as kind of, well, why did you choose an American? They already govern the world in a sense, and why do you want them also to hold the highest position in the Catholic Church?
Professor Seegers, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. Professor Mary Seegers is from Rutgers University. When we come back, we'll also be joined by Blaise Bompain, a former priest, and Angela Bonavoglia, who has written the book Good Catholic Girls. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
We are the
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we broadcast on over 330 stations around the country, on Pacifica stations and affiliates, on public access TV stations and NPR stations, PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. We're also video and audio streaming at democracynow.org, where you can see our Unembed the Media tour. We're headed to Philadelphia tonight, tomorrow night, Sarasota. We will also be in New York, Huntington, New York, on Wednesday, and this weekend in Omaha and Lincoln, Nebraska, Denver on Friday. We are talking about Pope John Paul II, his death, his legacy, and where the church goes from here. Our guest, Professor Mary Seegers of Rutgers University, in the studio, Angela Bonavolia, who is author of Good Catholic Girls, How Women Are Leading the Fight to Change the Church, Blaise Bompain on the Line, a former Catholic priest who worked in Guatemala. Angela Bonavolia, can you talk about the significance of John Paul and women in the church?
It's actually a mixed legacy, Amy. John Paul was definitely outspoken in terms of discrimination against women. He took a stand against violence against women, against discrimination against women. He cheered women on in terms of their roles in social and political, artistic, cultural, economic fields. Interestingly, what he left out of that was women's place in religion, in our own religion. Not entirely. He did appoint women to higher positions than they'd ever been appointed to before. He appointed the first two women to the Vatican Theological Commission. He appointed a woman to head a pontifical academy. So he thought of himself as a feminist, and there are Catholic women who think of themselves as papal feminists. However, his view of women was grounded in what is called the complementarity of the sexes, where he saw a great difference between men and women, and he saw women's contribution as basically in giving themselves to others each day. He wrote, women fulfill their deepest vocation. So he really saw women as nurturing. He saw qualities of humility, listening, waiting. So it was a notion of women in a passive kind of a capacity, although, as I said before, he did come out against discrimination against women. That said, during this papacy, there has been a tremendous tightening of the locking out of women from the area of ordination, which I think is a tremendously serious problem, because ordination in the Catholic Church right now is the only route to the highest levels of sacramentality. It is only through ordination that a woman can represent the divine, which I think is a truly important area of spirituality. It is only through ordination that women can have influence at the highest levels of power and authority. Right now, we see the consequence of this structure. And I think right now it is the structure of the Catholic Church hierarchy that is the biggest problem that we take into this new millennium. We have a structure that is based on an all-male, theoretically all-celibate hierarchy, and it has a vast amount of problems. And the other big area, I think, where we have women have really struggled and suffered in terms of their role in the church right now is in the private sphere. While women have been closed out in the public sphere by being closed out of ordination, in the private sphere, under this papacy, under this Vatican for the last 25 years, women's moral authority has been usurped by all of the really rigid sexual teachings that the church has promulgated, not only to Catholics, but around the world in trying to build it into social policies. And that ranges from no birth control, artificial birth control at all, no emergency contraception, even for rape victims, no condoms even to prevent the spread of AIDS, and no abortion under any circumstances. And those positions have been a great burden, particularly to the poorest women in the developing world, where the church has the greatest power. So those are two areas where John Paul's legacy is wounding, I think, to women.
Why was the Pope so opposed to women priests?
Well, he was a traditionalist, deeply committed traditionalist. So I don't at all feel, and I'm not saying that he came out of any hostility. He was a very traditional man, and it came out of his belief that this was the tradition of the church, that there had never been women priests, and that he felt he wasn't empowered to change that. But there are many theologians, and in writing my book, Good Catholic Girls, I interviewed many theologians who don't believe that that tradition is set in concrete and that it absolutely excludes women priests. In fact, the Vatican's own scriptural commission back in the 1970s studied the Bible to look for an absolute bar against women priests and concluded that it didn't exist in the Bible. They couldn't find that in the Bible. So there, it was tradition, but there are a lot of people who took issue with that position.
Mm-hmm. What about the issue on abortion?
Abortion is a much harder issue. Historically, the Catholic Church's position has shifted. It was always a sin. It wasn't always murder. In the earlier days, in the Middle Ages, there was the question of when does ensoulment occur in the development of a fetus, and that was the point at which abortion would become a sin, not before that. But gradually it has evolved to what we see now as a very rigid position in the Church. The groups like Catholics for Free Choice, they talk about, and a lot of Catholic women ethicists talk about primacy of conscience as being the basis for a woman's making what is a very difficult decision, and that this can be done in good conscience. And I think the Church's position, the rigidity of its position on abortion, it has to be looked at and contrasted in a way to its failure to take such a rigid position on anything else, on any of the other life issues. The Church is against capital punishment. It is against war except under very specific circumstances. But it has never said anybody who supports those things cannot come to communion, must be turned away at the altar. But it has taken that position with abortion. And on a purely political level, I think we have to ask why. And I think part of it is because it's a very patriarchal position and argument, I think. You can say that to women and you're not going to get as much opposition as if the church hierarchy had said to anybody who supports preemptive war or capital punishment, you cannot come and receive communion. So I think, you know, it's important to look at abortion within the context of the church's other teachings.
You talk in your book, Good Catholic Girls, How Women Are Leading the Fight to Change the Church, about some of those women who are leading the fight.
Yes.
Can you talk about Joan Chittister?
Oh, Joan Chittister is an extraordinary woman. She is a nun. She is an eminent orator. She's a prolific author, and she's a very progressive woman. She was invited to speak about women's ordination at the first international conference of women's ordination groups in Dublin, Ireland, several years ago. And as she was readying to go to that conference, a letter came from the Vatican to her monastery in Erie, Pennsylvania, saying that she was not to go to that conference. She was not going to be allowed to speak about an ordination, because at this point, ordination, Catholics cannot even speak about ordination. The case is supposed to be closed. At any rate, she felt she had to go to this conference. She said, I talk about women. I tell them not to stay in abusive relationships, and how could I let this abuse happen to me and not go and do this? And she thought she would be going by herself. But as it turned out, her entire community of Erie Benedictine nuns stood up in support of her. They all signed a letter to the Vatican saying she was going to go and speak in Ireland. They felt in good conscience that silencing wasn't the way for the church to go. And then Benedictine nuns at the other 22 monasteries in the country supported it too, and the Vatican backed down. And Joan went and spoke at that conference. I think that was a really important moment. That the publicity around that act, I think, emboldened a lot of Catholics who were progressive Catholics who by then had been feeling really oppressed by the church's silencing and rigidity in terms of a lot of these teachings. And I think it influenced some of the actions that were taken after the sexual abuse scandal broke in terms of people joining together to take positions.
What about that sexual abuse scandal?
women were key to the response to the sexual abuse scandal. That, I think, is a very important point. Had there been no Barbara Blaine, there would have been no Survivors Network of those abused by priests, and that was the most powerful voice in the United States in response to the sex abuse scandals. Barbara Blaine was sexually abused as a young woman from eighth grade through high school and spent years trying to get justice from the hierarchy in Detroit, where this happened to her. And finally, she did get justice, but it wasn't until she was about to go on the Oprah Winfrey Show that they finally relieved that particular priest of his duties. But Barbara started with a handful of people at a hotel room in Chicago in the late 1980s, survivors of priest child sex abuse, and that organization has grown into over 5,000 people and is really, those are the people who are advocates for survivors, who are pushing to get the hierarchy to meet with survivors, who are working to change laws that will make it easier to prosecute in terms of sexual abuse.
And the Pope's response to the
I think a lot of people would agree that it was lacking, and I think I don't think he ever took it seriously. People felt he didn't take it seriously enough, and I think the sorriest sign of that was the appointment of Cardinal Bernard Law to head a basilica in Rome. So not only was he not punished in a visible way, but he appeared to have been rewarded.
Law being the former Bishop of Boston.
Exactly, who resigned in disgrace because of the priests that had been moved around up there and all of the children, hundreds and hundreds of children, who were victims of sexual abuse in Boston, the Boston area.
We're talking to Angela Bonavoglia, who is the author of Good Catholic Girls. We're also joined on the phone by Blaise Bonpain, who is a former priest. He worked in Guatemala in the 1960s. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good Blaise. Morning, Amy. How are you?
It's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Your response to the tenure, to the reign of Pope John Paul II, 26 years.
Well, the most positive thing would be in the book written by Jonathan Quitney called Man of the Century. Jonathan, not being a Catholic, wrote about the political side of the impact of John Paul II. And I think that is very excellent. I knew Jonathan while he was writing the book. He passed away since. But the low point, I suppose, was his response to the death of Archbishop Romero, and that was a result of very poor advice from Cardinal Casariego of Guatemala, who was the only cardinal in Central America at the time. And Cardinal Casariego was a great supporter of the Guatemalan military and of militarism in general. He reminded me of Cardinal Spellman in some ways. So that was a very unfortunate thing. Coming from his strong anti-communist background, he reflected on Central America as on Poland, and that also was a very serious error when in March of 1983 he shook his finger at Ernesto Cardenal at a time when he was visiting Nicaragua, and 20 youth had just been killed in the Contra War, and the mothers of those youth were present, and they were holding pictures of their sons, and the Pope actually told them to shut up. He said, silencio. And then he shook his finger at Ernesto, and I think he misunderstood completely what was taking place in Central America at the time. And so that's a sorry part of the situation, but that's only part of it. There's also the matters to be dealt with, the matter of gays, not only in the church, but the matter of what is called gay marriage. The dialogue must continue into a new papacy to indicate that many people are simply asking for a property agreement with the state. Some of them understand that in the Catholic Church they aren't going to be married in the tradition, but they're asking for a property agreement whereby they can receive 100 different benefits of being married. So it is a question of what is called secular marriage that is being dealt with here. And I think that dialogue has not reached the church in its fullness yet, any more than the dialogue on abortion has, because if we wish to see a decline in abortion, we must look to the sociology of it, look to places like Holland, where it has declined because of excellent sexual education in addition to guaranteed health care. Those two things put together cause abortion to drop rapidly, whereas putting it under civil law as a crime seems to make the whole situation worse. So the dialogue on these issues has not yet been completed. But the sociology of Catholics is that as many of them practice birth control as Protestants or any other group, and the same applies to abortion. It is not the Pope has not been listened to on these events. What is taking place is what's called the sensus fidelium, the sense of the faithful, and that is that they must ultimately decide in their conscience. The Pope is not a line officer in the military. The last word in the Church is your personal conscience, and people have to follow that, and they are following it. Some call this a smorgasbord, Catholicism, but it's really not. It's a matter of saying, I have to make a stand in terms of what I believe is right, and that is completely an acceptable situation in the Church that has not received enough attention, I believe. So all of these issues remain to be dealt with far more fully than they have been dealt with in the past.
Blaise Bompain, a former priest who was kicked out of Guatemala as a liberation theology priest. When we come back, I want to talk more about the issue of liberation theology and also the Pope's opposition to war and fierce criticism of capitalism. This is Democracy Now! As we talk about the legacy of Pope John Paul II. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we talk about the legacy of Pope John Paul II with Angela Bonavolia, who is author of Good Catholic Girls and Blaise Bompain, a former priest. Can you talk about the opposition to war of John Paul?
I think it was absolutely outstanding, and I think it is quite tragic that the bishops of the United States did not pick up the cudgel after he made it clear his great opposition to war and to war in Iraq. The U.S. bishops took a very weak response, I believe, by not bringing that issue to each and every parish in the United States, almost giving one the feeling that they had a greater dedication to U.S. foreign policy than they did to their own church. And this, I think, is quite scandalous, and has been a history of scandal. The pro-war position of the leaders of the U.S. Church, like the famous Cardinal Spellman in the matter of Vietnam. So his position on war was excellent.
And capitalism?
And on capitalism, extremely interesting. We saw that he had a horror of Soviet communism, but when it came time for the first conference that he attended in Puebla in Mexico. I know I was there, and Bishop Romero was there. Archbishop Romero was present. This is 1979. The condemnation at Puebla was of unrestrained capital. He was very much against the deregulation. He was very much against what is called neoliberalismo today, the 19th century laissez-faire capitalism that showed only a regard for profit and no regard for the common good. So to the surprise of everyone at that conference, the only thing condemned in the conference was unrestrained capital, and Marxist analysis was kept as a methodology that was fully acceptable. He wasn't talking about people becoming Marxists as such, but the use of Marxist analysis, that is, to recognize class warfare, to recognize the lack of distributive justice in society, was completely acceptable. So these things were on the positive side. It was curious that prior to the conference in Puebla, the newspapers were coming out saying Pope John Paul II condemns liberation theology. Well, it just didn't happen. It was that the capitalist world was so afraid of what liberation theology implied that they wanted to condemn it in the press before the Pope even made a statement on it. So that part was of great interest to all of us, and liberation theology is simply a response to imperial theology, which has been with us since 312 A.D., since the time of Constantine, when with Constantine, the emperor, becoming a Christian, he brought the sword into Christianity and conversion by way of the sword. And that was ultimately seen in the Crusades, in the Inquisition, in the Conquistadores. And these are all things for which Pope John Paul II apologized. He was horrified by church history, and that included the Holocaust. And I don't know of any pope that had apologized for the history of the church prior to him. So he's an extremely complex man. There are many, many facets to this person. Some that we're sorry about, and many that we find quite unusual.
We're talking to Blaise Bompain, who himself was kicked out of Guatemala as a priest. Why, Blaise? This wasn't during the time of this pope.
No, it wasn't during the time of this pope. It was during a time of a revolution, and the church there, the cardinals I mentioned before, was under the direction of Cardinal Casariego, who was very, very close to the Guatemalan military, who had mentioned that if he were not a cardinal, he would like to be a military officer. And he was praising one of the most vicious, torturing, evil groups of militarists that ever existed. So a few of us were expelled and accused of fomenting revolution, which was a ridiculous thing to say. The people had started their own revolution back in 1960 after the intervention of the United States in 1954. So I was put under a gag order. I was told not to speak, not to write anything about Guatemala. And as a result of that, I went to the Washington Post and released all the information I had. And that went out to some 400 newspapers to prove that the U.S. was engaged militarily in Guatemala, that it was using napalm, that the Green Berets were there, and that this was our Latin Vietnam. And so this was not appreciated by church leadership at the time, and it made it clear to me that I had to just keep moving forward to pursue the truth as I saw it in this situation.
There was an extended piece in the New York Times, of course, about the legacy of John Paul. And they talked about Brazil. For example, the Reverend Leonardo Boff of Brazil, a movement leader silenced by Rome for a year. In 1992, he resigned from the priesthood to protest Vatican restrictions on writings by the clergy and members of religious orders. Another champion of liberation theology, the Reverend Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the first democratically elected president of Haiti, denounced the Vatican in 92 for recognizing military leaders who had deposed him in 1991. Since 82, when he became a priest, Father Aristide had excoriated the Haitian church for what he called its complicity with brutal dictatorships. Blaise Bompain.
Absolutely correct. John Bertrand Aristide was chosen by the people twice in a landslide, and the Haitian church and also the Vatican was very opposed to his position, as they were opposed to others in the clergy that went into politics, Miguel Descoto, Ernesto Cardinal, and others. And I think this was a grave error. These men were in a position of representing the people, the hopes, desires, and anxieties. They were fulfilling what Vatican II said we should be doing. And I think Vatican II, that is between 1962 and 1965, was a great threat to Pope John Paul II. He felt that the matter of hierarchy was being destroyed and that the base communities were being given too much power. So he reacted to the Vatican II, which had really ignited a fire in all of us, because we were told not to wait for orders from Rome. We were told to enter into these hopes, desires, and anxieties, hasta las últimas consecuencias, up to the ultimate consequences, wherever it took us. That led Jean-Bertrand Aristide into saying, all right, I'll be president if necessary. It led Ernesto Cardinal to say, all right, I'll be minister of culture. It led Miguel Descoto to say, all right, I'll be foreign minister. We've got to work on behalf of these people who are suffering, who are hungry, who are in misery, and they need to be liberated. So I think this is another example of the many of the sins of the church, the Haitian church, attacked Aristide. Other bishops in El Salvador attacked Romero. Casariego attacked Romero. All of this is part of the history of a very human church, and it's we have to look to these great examples. Jean-Bertrand Aristide is still president of Haiti, even though he's living in South Africa at this time. The man behind this, as you know, Pope was traveling to 120 countries, but the man responsible for enforcement was Cardinal Ratzinger, who was an extreme reactionary and who removed the license to teach from many priests, and some of them had to go forward on their own because they could not simply sit in silence and watch the faithful deteriorate spiritually and materially. So I think that we're going to see these changes continue, and what was called liberation theology will simply be called theology. I think it's a matter of removing the imperial trappings that had nothing to do with the teaching of Jesus, imperial trappings that have come into the church as a result of the Roman imperial power. And we'll see something much more pure, much more primitive, much less sectarian. The thing that's going to really change is this, that the West tried to define everything. We'll tell you all about God. We know all about God. And that's very embarrassing. We know nothing almost to say about God. The Buddhists and others have shown this with great reverence, that we don't know about this. We should simply stand in awe before the mystery. And the Pope made some terrible remarks about Buddhism, saying it was in effect an atheistic type of thing, and the Buddhists in Sri Lanka really opposed that. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done in terms of the presence of the church in the global sphere. And I think Pope John Paul II did a great deal to get that discussion going, to make it clear that we have to show great respect for existing religions, great respect for people who are non-theists, people who cannot affirm God, and to join together in what are known as the fruits of the Spirit, that where we see justice and peace and love and joy and endurance and courage, we're seeing the fruits of the Spirit, and those we can identify, whereas we can't define God, and we shouldn't try. And the West, including the Roman Catholic Church, has gone too far. We know everything.
Blaise Bonpain, on that note, I want to thank you for being with us, a former Catholic priest, now heading with his wife, Teresa Bonpain, the Office of the Americas in Los Angeles. And that does it for the discussion of the legacy of Pope John Paul II. We will end up today on this anniversary of the death of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. It's the 37th anniversary. He was assassinated on April 4th, 1968 in Memphis, Tennessee, 39 years old. Exactly 1 year before, on April 4th, 1967, he gave a major address at Riverside Church opposing the Vietnam War. This is an excerpt of that speech.
I come to this platform tonight to make a passionate plea to my beloved nation. This speech is not addressed to Hanoi or to the National Liberation Front. It is not addressed to China or to Russia. Nor is it an attempt to overlook the ambiguity of the total situation and the need for a collective solution to the tragedy of Vietnam. Neither is it an attempt to make North Vietnam or the National Liberation Front paragons of virtue, nor to overlook the role they must play in the successful resolution of the problem. While they both may have justifiable reasons to be suspicious of the good faith of the United States, life and history give eloquent testimony to the fact that conflicts are never resolved without trustful give and take on both sides. Tonight, however, I wish not to speak with Hanoi and the National Liberation Front, but rather to my fellow Americans. That is, at the outset, a very obvious and almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. There were experiments, hopes, new beginnings. Then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched this program broken and eviscerated, as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube.
An excerpt of the speech of Dr. Martin Luther King a year before he was assassinated, the speech given on April 4th, 1967. He was assassinated a year later, April 4th, 1968. This is the 37th anniversary of his death. As we wrap up today's program, we continue our Unembed the Media tour. Tonight we'll be in Philadelphia, University of Pennsylvania Law School, on Tuesday night in Sarasota at the Hyatt, speaking there. On Wednesday night, book review in Huntington, Long Island. On Thursday, I'll be co-anchoring the coverage of the John Bolton hearings in the Senate. John Bolton, nominated to be the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. I'll be co-anchoring with Phyllis Bennis from the Senate. On Friday at Mackey Auditorium in Boulder, Colorado, for the Conference on World Affairs. Saturday at Omaha, Nebraska, and in the evening in Lincoln, Nebraska. That does it for today's broadcast. The broadcast produced by a remarkable team: Mike Burke, Shreve Fadokadoos, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, and Ryan Abernathy, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.